It's been a year since the end of Trump's presidency and the beginning of Biden's. And while Biden pleaded for unity and the healing of bitter political divisions in his inaugural speech, the country remains as divided as ever. 40% of Americans say in polls they don't believe Joe Biden is the legitimate president. And the international IDEA's Global State of Democracy report now classifies the United States as a backsliding democracy, citing runaway polarization as one of the key threats. So is there still hope for American democracy? How exactly should we understand the phenomenon of polarization? Is it possible to overcome it by engaging more with the opposite side? And how might reading old philosophy books about different political realities help? Welcome back to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I welcome to the podcast Robert Talis. He is the W. Elton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University and author of numerous books on the nature of democracy, liberalism, and the American philosophical pragmatist tradition. His most recent book is called Sustaining Democracy: What We Owe to the Other Side. Robert is also himself the host of a podcast, New Books in Philosophy, as well as Why We Argue. And I'll add the links to both of these podcasts in the show notes. As you will hear, Talis has a novel interpretation of the nature of polarization that goes well beyond the idea that what defines polarization is the distance between the two sides of the political spectrum. Robert Talis, welcome to The Philosopher in the News.
Well, thanks for having me, Alexis. It's nice to talk to you.
So you recently wrote this article for the Institute of Art and Ideas about the nature of polarization, and you start that article by reminding us of the extraordinary fact that 40% of Americans say in polls that they don't believe Joe Biden is the legitimate president, implying presumably that the 2020 election was in some way stolen by the Democrats. Just to start with an easy question, is there hope for a democracy in which nearly half the voters contest or seem to contest the election results in this way?
It is an easy question. The answer is not pleasant. You know, if indeed 40% or upwards of 40% of the electorate do indeed hold that the winner of the 2020 presidential election, in fact, is fraudulent and illegitimate, that's a pretty clear signal of a deteriorating democracy. There might be some mitigating considerations about these kinds of results. You know, one wonders in investigating these kinds of polling results, you know, what the average voter thinks the word legitimate mm-hmm. might mean in this particular context, or what it means to say that the election was stolen. And it strikes me that in the States today, one of the parties, the Republicans, for the past at least 5 or 6 years, you know, have been very subtly, you know, running on a slightly implicit, sometimes explicit message that real Americans are Republicans. Right. And in fact, it strikes me that that's probably a pretty good encapsulation of the core of Trumpism. Trumpism, mm-hmm. we might say, is at its core the contention that only supporters of Trump are true Americans. Now, if you believe something like that, or if something like that thought is sort of implicitly in your political thinking, then it would follow, it seems to me, that any Democratic election in which Trump doesn't win has to be an election in which large numbers of people who are not properly American voted, which is fraudulent. Now, that's over-intellectualizing, I think, what is a much more implicit tendency in the political psychology of large numbers of Americans, which is why, you know, it's not uncommon in discourse online and, you know, in some media channels for Trump supporters to just state with a kind of incredulity. They say things like 71 million people voted for Trump. As if, you know, elections aren't decided, you know, in some indirect ways because of the Electoral College by what, well, it's not the number of votes, it's the comparative judgment. How many votes did the other guy get is what matters. But the idea that, you know, 71 million, you think Joe Biden got 80 something million votes? Like, well, If you say Trump got 70 million, and we know there's a certain number of voters, and we also know that there's a certain percentage of those voters that are going to vote for third party candidates or whatever, it seems like it's pretty easy arithmetic. Mm. So where are the other votes going? Right. So it's hard to know, I guess, what to make ultimately philosophically about these kinds of results. But if they are to be taken at face value, it's very disturbing. And I think that even if not taken at face value, even if we sort of massage it in a little way by saying, well, when you ask people, is Biden the legitimate president? They hear you as asking, are you happy with Biden as president? Would you have wanted Biden to be president? And they say no, you know, but even if you massage it in those ways, it's still disturbing because it reveals a kind of divestiture from, you know, ordinary thoughts about democratic elections and what an election is. Mm. How's that sound?
Yeah. I mean, your first interpretation specifically, I thought, is obviously quite a dark one, right? To see the other side as a legitimate almost from the get-go, right? No matter how many people vote for the other side is already, to begin with, illegitimate. The people who vote for that side are somehow not fully American. They're not fully legitimate voters. And maybe we can see claims around election fraud kind of coming out of that as well. And obviously we know there's a huge role that race plays in all this in America and so on. I wanted to hear what you thought about this kind of, yeah, this slightly more charitable perhaps or softer interpretation of what people are saying when they are asked, you know, do you think Joe Biden is a legitimate president? And I know there have been these kind of efforts in recent years, people working in this relatively new field, political epistemology, to explain, you know, why people answer polls in these surprising ways. And as you hinted at earlier, the theory seems to be that, well, people don't really believe this. They don't really believe that the Democrats stole the election. They just interpret the question as an instance where, you know, they're being questioned about their political loyalties. Are you with us or are you with them? So answering, yes, I believe the 2020 election was stolen is, you know, is a shorthand for saying I supported Trump and I hate Biden. Do you buy that account, and what do you make of it?
You know, it would be very surprising to me if there were just one explanation, or right, one kind of one read on how we get these surprising poll results. It seems to me that you know, in answering polls, people, some people are motivated to, as it were, troll or vandalize the poll, right? So they give answers that are supposed to help produce sort of very puzzling results or results that look unbelievable. And if you think of, you know, in the States that there is, you know, again, the Republican, our last Republican president, you know, Donald Trump spent a large part of his rhetorical capital while president, condemning the press. And so I could imagine that for those who still feel loyalty to him, the idea of sort of trolling polls, vandalizing political reporting is probably itself a kind of seen as a kind of act of political fidelity, you know, to their partisan loyalty, you know, to their partisan commitments. So I guess that there are some trolls. I believe that there are also some people who, you know, for whom, you know, certain kinds of political terms, again, legitimacy is one, fair and square. You know, these are terms that that feature into the questions that compose these polls. And I just don't know what the man on the street's view or conception is of the term legitimacy. And, you know, so I could imagine that there are some non-trolling, non-vandalistic responses that get you the surprising reply, only because these terms that have somewhat technical meanings in, you know, thinking about democracy, not only as philosophers, but just as political thinkers, I don't know that that the word legitimacy or fairly sort of, you know, trickles down into the consciousness of the ordinary American citizen in a way that carries the right kind of meaning. So I think that some of it indeed is, you know, as you suggest, as Michael Hannon suggests, as today in The Guardian, there's a piece by Musa al-Gharbi that makes this point that, you know, when people say, you know, did Biden win fairly, they hear that as, you know, are you happy with the result? Is it the result that you would most like? In a slightly more sophisticated way, though, I think you can also get this surprising set of poll results. When people hear, did he win fairly? And they hear the question as, if the election were conducted without the measures that were taken in a way to preserve election access due to COVID, right? If we were conducting this election without having introduced these, you know, new measures to help people vote, given that there was a pandemic going on, would we have gotten the same result? And I think that lots of people say, no, if it weren't for COVID, Trump would have won the election. And by the way, that doesn't strike me as an implausible, right? It's a horrifying thought, but it doesn't strike me as an implausible thought. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand why, you know, the lots of different forces sort of conspire, I think, to get us these kinds of results. Now, sure, last point, yeah. I also am sympathetic to the idea that, you mm-hmm. know, as philosophers, as political theorists, as political thinkers, you know, we spend a lot of time reasoning our way through questions about fairness and access and equality and citizenship and legitimacy and democracy. We spend a lot of time intellectualizing about these things. I just think it's a kind of error, you know, to attribute to ordinary citizens that very same level of intellectual activity when they're formulating their political, now I'm going to call them attitudes, right? I'm not sure that it's not just some Trump supporters that have political commitments that don't rise to the level of a theorist's or a philosopher's conception of what beliefs are. I just think that ordinary citizens are, you know, have attitudes that are more like dispositional tendencies to say and do certain things. You know, they've got conceptions of where their loyalties lie. I'm not so sure that belief is the right, at the end of the day, is the right sort of cognitive category to generally talk about people's political commitments across the board. Mm.
Yeah, so you think we're over-explaining sometimes as philosophers what might be going inside people's heads and how they might be approaching this particular question, whereas, yeah, maybe it's more of an instinctive reaction to a question or, yeah, just going with a certain attitude, as you say, towards these things.
I mean, let me just say one quick thing. You know, I tend to think that people's political commitments are, you know, are more like sports fandom than, you know, philosophical or ideological, you know, beliefs. Like, you know, you ask somebody like, okay, why do you like the New York Yankees so much? They're going to tell you all kinds of stuff that sounds like reasons, right? They're going to give what look like reasons. I just don't know that that's the right explanatory tool for talking about why. You know, why the guy who lives, you know, in North New Jersey likes the Yankees. You know, he'll give you reasons. I just don't think that that's the right explanatory framework to think about his being a Yankees fan, even if it might feel to him like the reasons are what explains his commitment to the team. I'm not so sure that that's not just sort of like a post hoc, kind of rationalization.
Yeah. I think we all do a lot more of that in our ordinary lives than we like to admit, even when it doesn't have to do with politics necessarily. The other sign that, you know, American democracy is in trouble, the main topic, I guess, of our discussion today, and it's something that concerned specifically, as you mentioned in your piece, the Secretary General of the International IDEA, whose recent report, Global State of Democracy report, classified the United States as a backsliding democracy. And the reason they cite is this runaway polarization. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, this isn't necessarily just a US specific phenomenon. You know, here in the UK, we have plenty of it, and we experience plenty of it, especially around Brexit. But it's definitely very, very pronounced in the United States. However, you think that most people have misunderstood what exactly this phenomenon of polarization is, or that most people tend to oversimplify it. So what do you understand as the usual account of polarization, and why do you think it's oversimplistic?
Sure, good. So, you know, the usual account of polarization is, you know, is an account that says that polarization is something like a measure of the doctrinal or ideological distance between opposing groups. So in that sense, polarization is always a matter of the relation between, you know, the distance between two groups that are in some way distinct and opposed. Now, you know, some, you know, useful information about politics is to be gathered by looking at, you know, the intellectual or doctrinal difference or distance rather between, say, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and whether the two parties have moved further apart on key, you know, legislative issues or agenda items. You know, there's lots of interesting information to be gathered there, and depending on what we mean or how we decide to measure ideological or doctrinal distance, we'll get a different answer as to whether the United States is markedly more polarized than it was 20 years ago. On some conceptions of ideological distance, it is. On others, it's not. However, one problem, I think, with that simple story about polarization is that it invites, I think, a pretty, you know, formidable criticism. If you think that the problem of polarization is that the two parties are pulling further and further apart, it looks as if the next natural thought is, well, by the way, this is mostly what animated Joe Biden's inaugural address, right? We've got to bring people together. We've got to unify. We've got to, you know, sit down and find common ground again. Now, well, that's fine. I'm not opposed to civility and hearing the other side and all the rest. I'm not opposed to that. But I do think that when polarization is understood strictly in terms of the distance between these two parties, and then the remedy is bringing the parties together, I think that some political, some citizens have a legitimate complaint. And they say, wait a minute, you know, polarization isn't my fault. You know, I'm not the one who shifted unreasonably, you know, to the extremes of my commitments. It's all on the other side. Why now do I have to then go and walk those extra yards to meet people in what now counts as the middle, right? So there's a kind of worry that the standard or the simplistic idea of polarization has a kind of both-sider error built into it, where it looks like we're already committing to the idea that polarization, the problem of polarization is the fault of both sides, and so that there's some kind of symmetrical distance that each party has pulled apart. And it looks like that's just, that's implausible, it seems to me, for reasons that, you know, have to do with where we started our discussion, where I think it's plausible to say, well, wait a minute, you know, one of the major parties in the United States has moved significantly more drastically to its extreme than the other. And it's a kind of, you know, mug's game, you know, to say, well, now the people on the one side have to go work to reach across the aisle. It's like, well, the other side pulled the aisle all the way over to the right. Why do I not have to go make up? You know, that changes where the middle ground is. That concedes something to the more radical impulses of the people on the other side. So I'm, you know, I just say I'm sympathetic to that idea. And it's led some, you know, Jennifer Rubin had a piece last month, I think, you know, it's the problem isn't polarization, it's radicalization. I'm kind of sympathetic to that. So if polarization really just is this metric of this distance between, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats or between liberals and conservatives, then, you know, it seems to me that it's a pretty thin, you know, a diagnostic tool. It's a pretty flimsy diagnostic tool for thinking of dysfunctions because it's, you know, it's a both-siders problem.
Although, I mean, if the description is just measuring the distance between the parties, I guess the distance can also just increase if only one party just moves much further to the right or to the left of where it stood, and, you know, the distance will still increase. It's just that it won't be symmetrical on both sides. And usually we say, well, both, but, you know, but there's this kind of both-sidism involved. And I think what's also characteristic of this is that each side thinks the other side has pulled away. So, you know, the right also accuses the left of becoming, you know, socialist or communist even in some ways, which, you know. But let's look at the kind of so this position has kind of two parts. One, the diagnosis, and the second is kind of like what we should do about it. And as you said, you know, the what should we do part is kind of, well, we need to find common ground somehow. And this was the Joe Biden kind of line in his inaugural speech, you know, almost a year ago. And soon after that, I had Elizabeth Anderson on the podcast, and part of the argument that she was putting forward sounded a lot like Joe Biden's argument. And I joked with her at the time. I said, are you secretly writing Biden's speeches? That I'd love to be for that to be true. So the idea was that, yeah, the way to treat polarization is very much along these lines. You know, we need to combat it by learning to listen to the other side, to show respect for the other side, to show tolerance and humility and empathy towards others, you know, try and see the way they look at the world, see the world through their own eyes. So tell me a little bit more about why you think that sort of position is either naive or one that isn't going to solve polarization. Why do you think that?
Well, so one sort of initial conceptual point, right? You know, there's just a difference between preventing something from bad from happening and fixing it once it's happened. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems to me that norms and practices by which we do civilly engage with the other side, listen to the other side, hear, you know, the other side, reach across the aisle, invite them over for coffee to talk about our differences and see where there could be common ground. These are all practices that I think are, you know, reliable ways of preventing certain kinds of political dysfunctions that might plausibly be regarded as polarization. Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't follow. And I, in fact, think it's not true that these are good strategies for fixing those dysfunctions once they, in fact, occur. And we've got some, you know, empirical reason to think I'm right about this. So, you know, we've got some experiments that show that once citizens are accustomed to regarding their perceived partisan foes as dishonest and irrational or naive or, you know, unpatriotic, all the rest, right? Once we're in the mode of seeing our perceived political rivals in these unflattering ways, exposure to even moderate messaging from the other side, you know, middle of the road messaging from the other side, confirm, you know, we take it as confirmation.
It's triggering.
Of all of our nasty, you know, estimations of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some experiments that were done where they've, you know, paid people money to go follow, you know, moderate Twitter feeds from the other side. And the result, you know, the results, maybe not surprisingly, horribly, the result was, oh, yeah, those people on the other side, they're worse than I thought.
Yeah.
Like, well, wait a minute. This is sort of just middle of the road stuff. This wasn't, you know, radical stuff on the other side. This is just the middle of the road. So it seems to me that even though, you know, practices where we come together and hear each other out and try to find common ground are really, you know, signs of a healthy democracy. We don't restore the health of our democracy by behaving as if these dysfunctions that have befallen us never befell us, right? You know, that's just a, you know, every physician in the world knows this. Right? Mm-hmm. So it seems to me, though, that, you know, part of what's getting lost in some of these discussions is a pretty important distinction between different senses of the term polarization.
Right, and you draw this distinction between political polarization, as you say, and belief polarization, and it's the second right. kind that you think that runs a lot deeper, and you know, it's not just mere divergence of opinion; it's you know, something a lot deeper. It has a kind of, as you describe it, distorting, almost cognitive effect. So tell us about what is belief polarization. How is it different from the other kind?
Good. So we'll call, just to get the terminology straight, we'll call political polarization what we were just talking about a moment ago, that metric of the ideological distance between politically opposed units, be they parties or groups of some other kind. Belief polarization, though, is a cognitive phenomenon that occurs within like-minded groups. So it's not a metric of the distance between your group and the opposing side. It's rather a shift that occurs within your group. You know, we could say it's a metric of an ideological shift that occurs in light of interactions mainly or only among group members. So mm-hmm. it's a very robust cognitive phenomenon. You know, we've got a kind of folk conception of the yes man phenomenon or echo chambers and, you know, cocoons and these sorts of things. But, you know, there's a pretty very robust, well-documented, thoroughly studied cognitive phenomenon called belief polarization that is underlying those sort of more folksy kinds of conceptions like the yes man phenomenon. So interaction among or mainly among like-minded others transforms us into more extreme versions of ourselves. And what I mean by that is not only do we come to adopt more radical versions of the beliefs that we hold on the basis of which we are a like-minded group, not only does the group shift to hold more radical formulations of their shared belief, they also become more confident in their truth, more likely to overestimate evidence in favor of their view, more likely to mm-hmm. dismiss counter evidence. They're more subject, it looks like, to the backfire effect. You know, attempts to correct them sort of produce a knee-jerk, you know, escalation in their degree of belief. So we become more fervent in our commitment as a group. Now, there are lots of, you know, interesting issues that epistemologists, you know, can get into about the difference between a shift to a more extreme content in your belief to a shift to a higher level of confidence in your belief. You know, I go into this in some of my academic work, but you know, we don't have to get into that here. But the thing that's really, really important is that, as we shift into our more extreme selves, we also become more committed to negative and, in some cases, degrading evaluations of anybody who doesn't agree with us. That is, by the way, this is not, shouldn't be surprising, I think, to philosophers. Like, yeah, the more obviously correct your views look, the harder it will be to see those who don't accept them as rational, right? It's like, well, it's obvious. Here's a hand in front of my face. You know, it's obvious. You don't believe that? Well, it must be that, you know, you don't have a command of the evidence, or you have a command of the evidence, but you don't know how to handle it properly. And you're in the grip of something that, you know, is distorting you cognitively, or you're just being a jerk, right? I mean, we could think about how sort of academic philosophical debates sometimes actually work this way. Like, it's obvious that P, you don't think so? Well, I've got three or four different ways of explaining that, and they all make you look bad. Well, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise that when people are thinking their thoughts about stuff that they regard as important, like justice, well, you know, the more I'm convinced that my view is right, the harder it is for me to see you as somebody who's thinking straight if you disagree. So, belief polarization not only makes us more extreme, I'm not so sure that extremity is as such is such a terrible thing, right? It might be that the more extreme views are closer to being true, right? So it's not that the extremity is the problem. It's that as we shift into our more extreme selves, we become less able to see those with whom we disagree as rational, trustworthy, reasonable, worth engaging with. And in fact, as we start attributing all of these negative sort of cognitive traits to those with whom we disagree, you know, again, philosophers can get interested in differences between sort of cognitive assessments and broader moral assessments. I happen to think that it's not surprising that they leak into one another. It's like, yeah, if I think that you think crazy things, I'm also going to think that you're an irresponsible human being, a depraved man, you know, not just irrational in the things that you believe about X, Y, or Z, but problematic across a broad range of evaluative categories. And so it seems that animosity towards the other side escalates in belief polarization. As we become more radical and more convinced, we become not only less able to see the other side as epistemically responsible and rational, we also come to see them as yucky, as depraved, as disgusting, as problematic across a range of evaluative categories. Now, the thought here simply just is, just to tie up the two threads, right? The thought here now just is, look, democracy requires you to preserve within yourself the capacities, moral or epistemic or otherwise, to regard, at least within a broad spectrum of disagreement, to regard people who disagree with you, whose views lie within that spectrum, as nonetheless citizens in good standing, entitled to an equal political say, and, you know, doing their job as fellow democratic citizens. Belief polarization erodes that capacity to see those with whom we disagree as nonetheless above board. That, I think, is the problem of polarization. It's not the two sides pulling apart. It's the erosion of characteristic, you know, essentially democratic capacities to manage disagreement while also regarding the other side in the disagreement as nonetheless entitled to an equal political say.
I wonder whether the term belief polarization here is a little bit sort of misleading somehow, because sort of what you describe is a much more all-encompassing phenomenon, right? It's not just about what you believe and how extreme those beliefs become or how strongly you believe them. It is almost, it becomes kind of an ecosystem, as you describe it. It's very tribal, right? You become, in your book, you describe how people end up dressing like each other, end up talking like each other, even how they pronounce different words, or the same words, rather, is a sign of, you know, what group they belong to, where they shop, you know, all these kind of cultural signify, you know, it stops being about what you believe about a policy. It becomes more about, you know, are you with us? Are you not? Are you dressed the right way? Are you not? Are you driving the right kind of car? Are you not? And if not, you know, that is what separates you. And one of the really striking things that I found in your piece, and which I think motivates your drawing this distinction between these two different kinds of polarization, is that actually, if you look at, you know, the kind of current political rifts in U.S. policy, you know, the divisions between Republicans and Democrats don't really track the differences in what people believe about different policies, right? Democrats and Republicans aren't thinking that the other side is the enemy because of the policy differences they have, but they become more like just the enemy, right? The other tribe. They're more, you know, morally corrupt, that's or right. anti-democratic, all that kind of stuff. So two questions there. Yeah, one is, is the belief polarization term the right one, given this kind of more all-encompassing phenomenon? And how come does it manifest itself so robustly when, if you look at what people actually believe about, you know, the minimum wage or gun control or abortion, there is much more agreement between the two sides than you would expect, given what we see as polarization.
So I agree with you, Alexis. You know, the nomenclature here is very, very difficult to get right. And so belief polarization is not a term I'm happy with. You know, by the way, the phenomenon that I'm calling belief polarization is more commonly in the experimental literature called group polarization, which strikes me as even worse. <You know? laughs> All of these phenomena are about groups, you know, right? So, you know, and, you know, right, there's right. Within the experimental literature, there's, you know, various attempts to, you know, draw, you know, to taxonomize various phenomena. And so, you know, there's a, you know, an established meaning of affective polarization, party polarization, elite polarization. So, and because these various categories are being proposed by researchers and empirical social scientists, each of whom may have their own, you know, their own like phenomenon they're trying to get at. It's not well regimented, as we might say as philosophers. In fact, it's not regimented. So belief polarization is a term that I use right. With you know, with some trepidation for the reasons that you just laid out. You know, the phenomenon is not strictly about the extremification of belief contents. It's about the escalation of confidence. It's about the growing or the exaggeration of fervency in one with which one stands one's epistemic ground. And then once you see that it's not just about the content of belief, it's the degree of belief and the confidence in one's epistemic posture or position, then you start saying, well, look, it's not even really just about epistemic stuff either, right? It's about affective stuff. It's about in-group loyalty. It's about out-group hostility. It's about the tendency to attribute to the out-group elevated levels, unreasonable, you know, sort of implausible levels of homogeneity. Right. That is a part of what happens in belief polarization is not only do we come to see the other side as yucky and foolish and ill-motivated, we also come to see them as monolithic, as homogeneous. We attribute to them an implausible degree of internal cohesion. Always, by the way, internal cohesion organized around the most radical and therefore often the most implausible version of the other side's views, right? So once you start seeing that this is very, there's lots of things going on in this very well documented phenomenon, like, well, what do you really want to call it? It's sort of hard to know, right? You know, whether to call it what to call it. So belief polarization, you're right, not an ideal term. It's just a matter of stipulation. But given these different layers, there's epistemic stuff, there's affective stuff, there's, you know, ways in which we are prone to attribute epistemic and affective stuff to the other side. By the way, part of the other thing that happens in belief polarization is we're more likely to see the behavior of people on the other side as a threat, as intended as a threat. So we're even sort of attributing stuff to the other side and not merely describing them in unflattering terms. Okay. Now, the second question that you asked, right? I think now we're in a good position to start to see how the answer works, right? Once we see that belief polarization is about this complex of epistemic and affective and attributional kinds of tendencies, say, well, yeah, belief polarization ultimately is a phenomenon let me put it this way. It's a phenomenon by which group identity, and in the United States, we can say the dominant sense of group identity among citizens is their political identity. And we could talk more about that if you like and how that happened. Belief polarization is a cognitive process by which political identity becomes centered in one's own conception of their social situatedness and then made salient as the primary organizing category for thinking about interpersonal relations and almost everything else. So once you see then that it really is tribal, and you know, that's another word that's got all kinds of baggage that I don't want to adopt, but once you see that it is about loyalty to one's political clan, then I think you start to see the answer to the second part of the question. Why is it that cross-partisan animosity is so prevalent? In fact, it's higher now than it's ever been since we've been able to study this kind of thing. Why is it that all of this cross-partisan animosity is so intense? When you look at the fact that, you know, average American, forget about what the parties say and the politicians, just look at rank and file citizens who are affiliates, maybe not official members of a party, but who identify as Democrats or Republicans. It's like, yeah, they're not more divided over rubber hits the road policy than they were 40 years ago. They just despise each other a lot more intensely. Well, why is that? Well, I think because it's like, it's not really about, you know, it's not really about politics. It's about identity. It's about commitment. It's about loyalty, right? Hating the other side becomes a way of signaling to your friends that you are an ally, right? And in fact, last point on this, you know, one of the features of belief polarization that is robust but doesn't get talked about, which is, you know, why I talk about it so much in the new book, is that our more extreme selves are more conformist, right? We're the more extreme we get in our attitudes and our beliefs and our commitments, the more interested, the more invested we become in establishing clear boundaries between our group and the other group. And that means we become more and more invested in policing those boundaries, which means that sort of the standards, the requirements for authentic membership as one of us start escalating, which means that more extreme groups are also more homogeneous, more invested in their homogeneity, by which I mean conformity. They're also more hierarchical. You've got a group that is interested in establishing clear signals of who's in and who's out. That group has got to rely on, you know, a pretty small number of centralized tastemakers to set the standard. By the way, this is all just what we all know from high school. It's just cliques.
Yeah. It's very primitive, isn't it?
And how terrible were they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of hate usually kind of evolutionary psychological explanations of political phenomena and social phenomena, but it does give you this kind of ring that there's something kind of very primal about these instincts of the kind of in and out group and the boundaries and thinking of the out group as really kind of the outcasts and so on. But one of the things that you highlight in your book is that this phenomenon is also interesting because it doesn't afflict only kind of opposing parties, but ultimately comes to sort of poison relationships within each side, the relationships with our own political allies, you know, the people that we're supposed to be friends and allies with. We vote for the same party, we vote the same way. So why is that? And why are you so concerned about this? You know, if at the end of the day, you know, the Biden wing, say, of the Democratic Party and Ocasio-Cortez, the Ocasio-Cortez wing of the Democrat Party end up voting in the same way, does it matter that they end up belonging in these very different tribes and have these very different and terrible views about each other?
Well, I mean, as a legislative matter, it might not. It might not be such a problem. But, you know, let's go back for a second to the concern about the simplistic story about polarization. Remember that I was saying I was I was sympathetic with the idea that when we think of polarization as the ideological distance, it looks like it's a kind of both problematic both-siderism, and it's calling upon the people who are still within the bounds of democratic norms to take those extra steps, you know, to reach across an aisle that's been shifted far in the direction of the other side because the other side is behaving very badly, right? And that looks unfair and democratically degenerative and all the rest, and I agree with that. But once we see that polarization is, as a diagnostic of democratic dysfunctions, is better understood as the interplay of these cognitive phenomenon by which we become more extreme, more conformist, more likely to dismiss the other side, more disgusted with them, you know, that sends, you know, that makes the world of politics, the world of winning elections, kind of easy for the parties and their candidates. Once you can, if you're a candidate, you can count on your likely base to have similarly negative appraisals of the other side. Then you're not going to have to, on the campaign route, you're not going to have to get into the details of your tax position, your position on taxes, right? Or school choice or whatever, or immigration, whatever it might be, catchphrases that are aimed at simply stoking the resentment and indignation towards the other side are, you know, strategically all you need. And by the way, in the US, this is true in other democracies too, but in the US especially, you know, winning elections at the national level has almost nothing to do with convincing anybody to change their thinking about anything. It's all about motivating the people who are already on your side, right? And, you know, it turns out that, you know, fear and indignation and resentment and disgust, these are really good behavioral motivators across the board. And it turns out they're good behavioral motivators for political behavior, which is what candidates' job is, to get you to do things. Okay. So once we see that belief polarization incentivizes, you know, certain strategies for candidates and parties to amplify and exaggerate their differences, which then feeds back into our tendency to be tribal and hive together with, we can see that these two things work together in ways that that constitute a kind of loop, a kind of self-reinforcing spiral, right? All of which spells, you know, all of which means that democratic capacities are being eroded. Okay. Now, to get to the question, the tendency of belief polarized groups to become more conformist, I think, is problematic because as we become more and more convinced of the depravity, the total depravity, the contemptuousness of the people on the other side and seek to dismiss them, well, then we're just left with our allies. But belief polarization makes us more tribal in the conformist sense. And what that means is that our conception of acceptable doctrinal variation among our allies shrinks as well, right? And so you see this, by the way, if you casually look online, right? You can see this happening in real time in your social media feeds, right? You know, left-leaning Americans are very good at getting along when the topic of their interaction is their contempt for Trump and Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, and on some days, maybe most days these days, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, right? It's really very cohesive and, in fact, sometimes very informative, right? When people say, you know, like, here are some problems with the other side, here's what they're doing, here's the right critique. So they're very good on critique. But go back and look at your social media feed on the night of the Met Gala when AOC was wearing her Tax the Rich dress, and forget about the critiques of her coming from the conservatives and the Republicans. Just look at the progressive feeds. Once the discussion turned to the topic of what tax the rich means, not only did you get lots of disagreement, which, by the way, is fine. That's good, right? What does tax the rich mean? But very quickly, those disagreements devolved into disputes over who the real progressives are. That is, those disputes over what the tax policy should be among Democratic Party-leaning, leftward-leaning progressives who've got legitimately, there are lots of different kinds of progressive views about taxation, it seems to me, lots of defensible views about taxation that are available to people who are left-leaning, who vote for the Democratic Party, who are even progressive. But that's not those debates looked like. Those debates quickly became debates over who's the real progressive and who's no better than Ronald Reagan. And so, when our conception of acceptable doctrinal variation gets shrunk in belief polarization, we lose the ability to tolerate disagreements among our allies, which means our political coalitions begin to splinter and factionalize and shrink. They therefore become politically less effective. So it undermines our political objectives. And moreover, right, the same democratic capacities erode. So again, when we dismiss the other side as irresponsible, as beyond the pale, as divested from democracy, in some cases, as we should, right? The cognitive phenomenon of belief polarization doesn't dissipate. It just turns you against your friends and makes your political coalitions inoperative. That strikes me as the real worry. This is not a both-sider thing. It's like, for the sake of argument, I say this a lot when I give these talks. Say, for the sake of argument, I will accept whatever assessment, evaluation you want to give of the people on the other side and why they're too depraved to talk to. I'll grant it. The people on the other side are not interested in democracy anymore. They're fascists. I grant it. That doesn't mean that the problem goes away, because now it's just us. Well, we still are not going, the fact that we vote for the same people doesn't mean that we agree. Here's just one very quick example. Here are two positions in the United States that seem to me to be, plausible positions and even popular positions on the more progressive side of liberal politics, both of which have to do with the sort of defund the police stuff. Again, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain kinds of pretty robust programs for criminal justice reform. Okay. And then there are prison abolitionists. Now, I think both of those views are defensible, by the way, right? Available to people, right, on the progressive side of American politics. But those are disputes that are nonetheless disputes about what justice requires. Those are not any less animated disagreements than the disagreement you might have, a Democratic voter might have with the Republican who wants to give more tax breaks to rich people. It's like, that's a disagreement about justice. It's no less a vehement disagreement between the prison abolitionist and the person who says, there should be prisons, they just need to be reformed, right? It's like, that's also a disagreement about justice. Now, once you dismiss the conservatives as being divested from democracy and too depraved to care about talking to, okay, now the prison abolitionist and the criminal justice reformer are going to have to decide what the policy is going to be. And that's also a disagreement about justice that seems to me to be, have potentially within it as deep a divide as the divide between, the trickle down guy and the progressive taxation guy. Mm-hmm. So our disagreements don't go away once we get rid of our partisan opposition, because there's lots of opposition among our allies that needs to be navigated. Polarization erodes our capacity to navigate them. And that's just bad for democratic politics, irrespective of, you know, the depravity of certain, you know, certain trends within major parties in the country. That's why I think polarization remains a problem.
Yeah. There are two things here, right? One is this is still bad for democracy. So there's a kind of moral argument still here that, you know, if this belief polarization doesn't just erode relations between different sides of the spectrum, of the political spectrum, it erodes relationships within each side. And then, you know, where does that leave us if we can't even talk to our own side, if we can't see them as kind of legitimate positions, you know, where are we going with that? But it's also kind of practically a terrible direction to be going in, right? Because, I mean, how are you going to win elections if you give up on, you know, convincing any voters on the other side and you say, okay, what we're going to do is expand our base and like double down on our base. But then the base also becomes fragmented in these like mini tribes that, you know, each has a different version of the truth that they're defending and see the other sides as, you know, how are you going to win any elections like that? It seems like a dead end kind of strategy.
Good. Can I just add one other sort of practical problem here?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one might say, with some justification, by the way, that the dysfunctions of belief polarization now are more prominent on the conservative side of the political spectrum in the United States. And there's some reason to think that. There's some evidence that suggests that. I'm just going to grant it.
Mm-hmm.
It does not follow from that belief polarization is not problematic across the spectrum, right? You know, might be more severe in some regions. Doesn't mean that it's only problematic in the most severe, you know, enclaves where it occurs. But secondly, and more importantly, it strikes me that even though belief polarization, let's just grant, is more prominent among, you know, people on the conservative side of the spectrum of U.S. politics, it still seems to me arguably the case that belief polarization, even in the lesser extent to which it prevails in the more progressive-leaning side of the spectrum in American politics, belief polarization is more destructive to progressive political agendas for the following reason. Progressive political agendas, it strikes me, it's more integral to their success to preserve the conditions under which many different kinds of flowers can bloom, right? Because they have to be more experimental. They have to be more interested in trying different things, it strikes me. When you're on the conservative side, you're interested in maintaining the status quo or reestablishing something that's already been mm-hmm. tried. Progressives seem to me to be more dewy and experimental in their political agenda. And it seems to me that when the name of the game is political experimentation and exploration, conformity is more destructive to political coalitions that are left and progressive leaning than it is to conservative coalitions. So even if it
undermines its own political project.
That's right. That's exactly it.
So what do we do, Robert? I mean, you said that when we started this conversation, talking to the other side is not going to be the solution. And you also say that you don't think this can be solved. We can manage the problem, that we can manage belief polarization. What do we do to manage it? What's the remedy?
Well, so, yeah, you know, let me say one very quick thing. I'm not an optimist. I don't do optimism. I don't think that it's not always clear to me that democracy prevails, you know, given where we're at. So, you know, what can we do given where we're at to try to manage these destructive tendencies, I think, is what we need to focus on. You know, I'm a pragmatist, right? So, you know, like, what can we do now to try, you know, we're not guaranteed to succeed. So what can we do now to try to make things better? And I wanted to say three quick things. In my 2019 book, which is called Overdoing Democracy, I argued that one thing that needs to be done is citizens need to rebuild, to rediscover, to construct venues and sites for pro-social interaction in which politics is beside the point. One of the things that goes along with these dysfunctions we've been discussing is the politicization of everyday activities, where shopping at Whole Foods becomes a way of being a Democrat, right? Driving a truck becomes a way of being a conservative. And so what that means is that the social spaces you and I inhabit, well, the social spaces people in America inhabit in their day-to-day lives become more and more saturated with political significance, such that they are ways of signaling to other people what your politics are. So, you know, these are obvious trends in the US. You know, you see a person in the park wearing yoga pants. That's a really good indication that they voted Democrat, by the way.
Yeah.
You see a guy wearing camouflage attire, camo. It's like, that's a real popular attire choice for conservatives. Mm-hmm. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, conservatives and liberals decorate their homes differently. They prefer different kinds of colors. They watch different kinds of movies. They listen to different music. They live in different parts of the same city even. So, you know, we can go through the whole way in which politics has saturated things. But what that means is that everyday social experience with others, even in, most importantly, perhaps in the case of unplanned encounters with other people, you know, are designed, have the tendency to attach our conception of the various virtues people can display in these kinds of interactions with their partisan loyalty. So our conception of the good neighbor becomes coterminous with our conception of the liberal voter. Our conception of the dependable coworker becomes coterminous with our conception of the partisan ally. And I think that that's got to be broken. Now, in the Overdoing Democracy book, I talk about how difficult it is to break it, but maybe there are ways to do it. That's one thing. So to sort of find non-political ways of cooperating, where we're not suppressing our political differences, you know, reaching across the aisle still puts politics at the center. That's not what I'm talking about. We just do things in which it's just like, I don't know what your political identity is. Just not what we're up to
it's
today.
It's not relevant.
Yeah, right. It's just beside the point.
Playing bowling
That's right. Yeah. Good. That's one thing. Now, the new book, the Sustaining Democracy book, sort of tries to do two other things. It says, well, you know, we do have to do politics at the end of the day, right? It can't just all be non-political modes of interaction. We do have to interact politically. How are we going to do that? We can't just put that on hold. And so I want to say two things. One you know, we have to figure out ways within our political coalitions and alliances to promote, to incentivize disagreements among allies. That is, we've got to operationalize or adopt as a set of norms or incentivize even naysaying, even, you know, to use sort of an old figure, you know, even sort of devil's advocacy. We need to take steps within our among our political allies of normalizing the appreciation of doctrinal variation so that we can exercise, right, our abilities to disagree with somebody about justice and yet not
think they're scum.
Good. And not consign them to the ranks of the democratically divested, contemptible opponents of democracy itself. So that's one thing. And how that's done, you know, is in part has to do with, and propose in the book, you know, part of what we need to do is to stop thinking about interactions with our partisan foes as necessarily focused on pro and con debates. You know, that's modeled in social media, on the nightly news all the time. It's, you know, pro gun control, anti gun control, you decide kind of stuff. Now, that's one mode of interacting with a disputant. But it's not the only mode, and I think it's not the mode that's most important from the point of view of depolarization or managing polarization. I think rather that what needs to be done is we need to create more venues by which political opponents can interact on the basis, not of a pro and con debate, but on the basis of, I'm for more gun control. Where do you think my view fails? I don't want to hear about your anti-gun control argument. Don't tell me that. Just why are you not convinced by my side? What's the weakest part of my argument? Now, that's not because we need to all be Millie infallibilists about our political thinking. Maybe we do, but that's not the point here. The point here is just that, you know, you need to see your political adversaries as people from whom you can learn, even if what you're learning only is better ways to articulate your view, different ways of articulating.
Why do they think the way they
think? Yeah, good, 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 right. And why do they think we're wrong? Why are they not convinced by my totally solid argument for, you know, for gun control? Where do they think I go wrong? And that's just a way of discovering that among allies, there are different ways of formulating ideas, different ways of thinking the thoughts that make us allies. That's important. Lastly, and this is the part that maybe won't be surprising to the philosophers in the room.
This is the philosopher's solution. Yeah, more philosophy.
I think that, we tend to think of civic activity, of exercises of citizenship as publicly observable mass activities. And for good reason, that is part of what democracy is. It's, you need to join a choir if you want a democratic voice. I get it, right? Democracy happens out in the streets. You know, I get it. I'm not denying that. I think, though, that we've lost sight of the fact that democracy doesn't need us only to be active participants. It does. It also needs us to be reflective. And political conditions are such, I would argue, based on the basis of things that we've already said, political conditions are such that they undermine our reflective and especially our imaginative capacities. So what I want to suggest is one of the ways in which, one of the steps we can take to try to mitigate and manage belief polarization among allies is to spend a little more time alone, to spend a little more time out of the assessing gaze of the people who want us to conform to out to the standards of good membership in our alliances and the people who want to find in our behavior evidence of our corruption, right? To spend more time alone thinking political thoughts that are not political thoughts about us, right? That is that we also think that politics is now, right? Politics is always what's going on to us right here and right now. You know, it's not always about us. You know, maybe there's some political significance in a kind of grappling with political questions and ideas and arguments and even problems that aren't our problems and aren't our ideas and aren't our debates. The book ends with this, you know, like, yeah, sitting at home in a room reading Hobbes, who's worried about, you know, real bloodshed for good reason, right? You know, that's a civic activity too. Not because you're trying to find out from Hobbes what we should do about the filibuster, but because exposing oneself to political ideas and thinking and problems that are foreign or alien to the political context you and I find ourselves in, that's significant civically. That is that itself is an act of citizenship.
I like that idea a lot, and it's something that the ancient Greeks also did, right? There's a theory that that's what they were doing with their plays, for example, that, you know, the reason why tragedies were set in a different place in a different time with a different political setup was part of that. Part of the reason was that was to sort of exercise their political imagination and think of different times and different kind of civilizations or cultures. But I guess there's one obvious kind of counter or an obvious kind of objection to this, which is, well, let's look at all these kind of philosophy professors who like study all these texts and think about them, and that's kind of their bread and butter and what they do for a living. do their politics really reflect that? Do they not all end up kind of quite homogeneous and believing quite similar things, most of them voting Democrat, most of them living in those kind of somewhat more affluent kind of neighborhoods, you know, shopping at Whole Foods, whatever it is. So I like the idea, but what makes you think there is reason to believe that it will work?
That's a good point. I think that when we, as I believe is the tendency, even among academics, to read the political texts of our tradition, you know, of our political philosophy tradition, as ways of, or as lenses through which to interpret the present, I think that's pretty prominent in political philosophy among academics, that we read Aristotle as a way of thinking about the politics of the day. And we read Aristotle as a way of identifying how even great minds can be derailed by, you know, the cultural prejudices with respect to women and non-Greeks, in Aristotle's case, as it may be. And so, you know, and again, I'm not saying that that's not valuable. I'm just saying, yeah, but at some point, right, engaging with political ideas that aren't ours, political problems that aren't our problems, right, has a value for thinking about our political problems, right? That they are not that we're engaging with ideas not for the sake of translating them into contemporary terms, but sort of inhabiting their alienness, as it might be, right, is an important civic act. And I would say, you know, even though in the book I do talk about, you know, sort of reading, like, you know, texts that are historically distant in time, I would say the same thing, like, well, you know, following the contemporary news of a democracy that's very much unlike your own, like, you know, reading about what's, you know, the parliament in India, whatever, you know, that also might have an important effect. We just say, well, wait a minute, there's more to political thinking. There are more views available on the spectrum of acceptable opinion within a democracy. Like the spectrum of acceptable opinion within a democracy goes far beyond, you know, the opinions that are most salient to us as contemporary citizens of the US or the UK, right? That is that, you know, there are things that can be thought. And the reason why I think it's important is because, you know, that politics is so, partisan identity is so saturated our experience, so impregnated our thinking, penetrated our thinking, that, you know, I think that we have lost sight of the possibility of a political future that's unlike the present, not because we've overcome the other side. We're familiar with that, right? We just finally throw all the other people in jail and, you know, then, you know, we get to have our way. No, we're familiar with that thought, but we've lost the ability to imagine a political future that's unlike our own because the battle lines are just drawn differently, you know, because people have changed, because, you know, we've prevailed. The people on the other side now have a view that is opposed to our view, but no longer off the rails, not because we've rehabilitated the crazies on the other side, whoever they may be, but just because the political context has changed. You know, even if you go back and read, sort of American political commentary from the 1930s and 40s and 50s, you know, there is a kind of disorientation that comes with that. Like, wow, you know, here's John Dewey, you know, in his day, undoubtedly a progressive, right? Writing at the end of his major political treatise, The Public and Its Problems, about the importance of a common language. It's like, well, wait a minute, what could it be? What political world, right, allows on the progressive side of the political spectrum an argument for a common spoken language? It's like, well, that's a different world from our world. Okay. Well, I mean, you know, there's a tendency to say, well, so what's the worst for John Dewey? Maybe.
Let's cancel Dewey. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever.
That would be
But just like, just saying, look, the ways in which the positions are contoured, the ways in which the spectrum is contoured is contingent, right? It's changed. Mm-hmm. And last point, thinking that politics is the battle between our side and the other side, as they are now defined, almost ensures that things will stay the same because the parties, as they now exist, benefit too much from the way things are. They want to perpetuate it. No matter how often Joe Biden or anybody else talks about bipartisanship and bringing people together and overcoming, you know, the toxic nature of our politics. You go read George Bush's remarks about the 20th anniversary of September 11th. You get the same kind of thing. Like, no matter how much lip service is given to this message of unity, which is very popular across the partisan spectrum in the United States. In fact, very popular among citizens across the partisan spectrum. Each, you know, everybody thinks the other side is to blame for the division, by the way. Say, like, no matter how popular a message it is, no matter how common it's sold, it's like the candidates and the parties benefit too much from the status quo to want to see it really change. Partisan animosity is good for them. So if there's going to be a change, it has to come from, you know, from doing things differently in our own ways of thinking about and reflecting on politics. That's what I think ultimately the right management strategies lie.
I was going to ask you our final question, which is to recommend a book that is on the topic that we've been discussing, which is, you know, polarization and democracy. But maybe I should ask you about a book that will fulfill in your view this function of taking us out of our politics and out of these topics and out of the problems that we're dealing with today, and something that will exercise our political imagination and immerse us into a different political world. So what would you recommend to someone for that?
Well, you know, again, I'm going to be a very predictable philosopher and say Plato's Republic strikes me as a whole, not just the anti-democratic stuff or the stuff that's critical of democracy. I think that the Republic is a political, philosophical / moral investigation that is not only magisterial in its comprehensiveness, but I think, you know, begins with some problems that will be very familiar to us, people who think that politics is just power and might makes right. But then very quickly, in addressing those positions and criticizing them, goes into some unfamiliar, you know, sort of unfamiliar, I teach the Republic fairly regularly, unfamiliar territory that that will almost always seem alienating in its unfamiliarity, but I think repays reflection, right? I think that the discussion of the tyrant and where the tyrant goes wrong or how the tyrant goes wrong in book 9 is really an important, you know, working through that, thinking one's way through the psychology of tyranny, even in ways that aren't just trying to diagnose, you know, the Trump people or whatever, but just trying to think of, you know, what are the costs of getting everything that you think you want? I think that that's an important act of citizenship. So Plato's Republic.
Robert Halice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alexis. It's been really nice talking.
As always, this podcast was created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. To find out more about the journal and its new online series, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. As loyal listeners might have noticed, we've had a bit of a break over the past month or so, but aim to return to our regular schedule of bringing you the philosophy behind the news every other week. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again soon.